You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We've got a brilliant show for you today. Hattie Williams joins us to talk about her debut novel, Bittersweet, which is partially set in Brighton. And the wonderful Catherine Bradley returns with her new book, The Institution, an absolutely gripping thriller that feels very, very close to home. Stay tuned, because at the end of the show, I am joined by my friend, collaborator and brilliant writer, Kate Beals, because we are running an affordable writing retreat in the heart of beautiful Italy in March 2026. We're really excited about it. We ran one earlier this year. It was really successful and we are so looking forward to doing it again. We've got a few places left, and the link to the website is in our bio on Instagram at BTM Book Club. If you are a writer or a facilitator or have an event that covers books and writing in the Sussex area, we would love to hear from you. So you can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com with your pitches for future shows. The show is also available as a podcast, and you can download that from wherever you get yours. If you fancy giving us a little review, that would be brilliant. I loved recording this show. We really got into it with these brilliant books. I really enjoyed reading them, and there is a lot to discuss. So enjoy. Charlie is 23, single, and the new publicity assistant at the independent London publishing house Windon & Shane. Richard Aveling is 56, married, and the author that has defined his generation. Charlie has long idolised the charming, illustrious writer, who also represents a link to her late mother, who loved his work. But as they embark on an illicit and all-consuming affair, Charlie is forced to hide the relationship from everyone she cares about. And when the success of Richard's latest book launches him to a new level of fame, where all anonymity is lost, she realises she might just be in too deep. Hattie Williams, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much for having me, Anna.
Thank you so much for coming on. So you are obviously a Brighton-based writer, but this is a very claustrophobic, engrossing novel set in London. When did the idea come to you?
The idea came to me kind of like lightning it would have been March 2023. I just had a baby and I'd taken a year off work, and my husband had a year off, and so we decided to go and live in Iceland for 3 months. So that's what we did. We went off to Iceland, and I have a lot of friends in Iceland. I was running the Iceland Noir Literary Festival at the time, so I was kind of involved in the literary scene there. And a lot of my Icelandic friends were just like, why don't you just write a book? And it hadn't occurred to me that you could just write a book. You had to kind of have this big idea. So one night I opened a Word document, and the first scene in the book where Charlie meets Richard came to me very clearly. So I kind of put that down on digital paper that night. The whole book kind of followed over the next 7 weeks. So yeah, it was quite a quick process from idea to writing the book. I kind of wrote it very furiously. And doing everything that you shouldn't do, writing for kind of 6-7 hours a day, just relentlessly until I had the first draft down.
And so you've worked actually both in the publishing industry and in the music industry. And I'm really interested why you decided to set this book in the publishing industry rather than the music industry, if that was conscious or if that was just how it came to you.
It is kind of how it came to me. I worked in music mostly as a musician. I did a short stint working in the music industry, but by this point I'd worked in publishing for about 12, 13 years. So I felt I knew publishing very well, and I felt like I had a lot to say about it. I'd just come out of like a full-time, very corporate senior role and gone freelance. And I think I kind of needed to get some stuff out of my system. I think also... I think so often the reason we don't write is we feel that we need to come up with some huge kind of high concept literary idea with world building, kind of like Margaret Atwood-esque books. And actually, I think what allowed me to write this book and the reason I could write it so quickly is because I knew this industry intimately. So mm-hmm. I think that was a really helpful part of it. But yeah, I think kind of write what you know is a really kind of good thing to say to people when they're trying to write their first book. It's like, yeah, what kind of, you know, your worldview, your experience, things you've been through may seem dull to you, but probably won't seem as dull to other people. Publishing is a really rom-com job as well, so I'm lucky in that it's an industry people are always interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. So, without the implication at all that you would ever have had an affair with an author, no judgment if you did. How much of your own experience did you draw on to write Bittersweet?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, I maintain that any author that tells you their debut novel isn't at least in part autobiographical is probably lying. But I mean, why not? No, I didn't have any affairs with any married authors. I gave Charlie, the protagonist, a lot of my own experiences. I gave her my old job as a publicity assistant. I gave her a lot of my friends. I gave her this strong feeling I had of being an outsider, of feeling like I was from a different world to my colleagues. I also gave her a lot of my grief. Like Charlie, I lost my mum when I was a teenager, and I think that was a really helpful thing for me to kind of write about. I'm not Charlie. I mean, there's probably a bit more of kind of 23-year-old me in Charlie than I like to believe. A lot of my friends that knew me back then are like, "She's you." I'm like, well, I don't think so. I think she reacts differently than I react to a lot of things. But yeah, I did certainly give Charlie a lot of my experiences.
So you write grief in such a warm and beautiful way. I also lost my mum when I was very young as well. So I found that really, like, really affecting and really beautifully done. And I think that it's often quite a lazy trope that writers use to have, especially young motherless women in books, to kind of explain a lot of why they're so kind of quote unquote messed up. But I thought that you did it in a really raw and beautiful way and showed how grief can kind of permeate, years and years on, and how, you think you might be okay with it or healed or sorted, and then it can come and hit you like a truck. Was it important to you to write grief in this kind of very raw, very realistic way?
Yeah, definitely. Grief's a funny one. It's not linear at all, is it? And I think that was, something I really wanted to write about. I think I'm essentially really interested in the things that happen to us as kind of adolescents and children and how they shape us as the adults we become. And, for unfortunate people like yourself and myself who lost a parent very young, that is kind of a monumental thing to happen. It disrupts your development so much. I talk about this quite a lot, of this kind of version of me when my mum died is kind of suspended in air, and you kind of then, take on another part of your personality. Like, you kind of move on so quickly from who you are when these big things happen to you, that it can be, I think you have to have had something like that happen to you to really understand just how difficult that is. But yeah, I mean, by the time I'd written this book, my mum had been gone for kind of around 20 years, and I was still kind of, dealing with the fallout of it in so many ways, especially just, having become a mother myself. I feel a lot of it kind of came back. Overall, I feel it was an incredibly positive experience writing about that grief. I think we all, when we've had bad things happen to us, this is why therapy is so important, is it's finding a narrative, it's finding a way of telling your story, of understanding your own story. These things that happen to you, often when we've lost a parent when we're young, we've probably got a bit of PTSD from, kind of how it happened and, what you've kind of witnessed as a child in those horrific situations. And writing this book for me closed a chapter on some of that grief, because I was able to kind of write about it, really nurture that story, nurture the language I was using, and really think about that on the page. And, writing's not supposed to be therapy, but I think for so many of us, it kind of is. I think just to kind of add to that as well. I mean, I did, when I first wrote the first draft of this, I think I wrote about my grief in a more personal way in that kind of first draft. And I think then it is, as a writer, kind of going in and layering things, keeping some things for yourself, some places where you feel a bit too exposed, or you feel like it's a bit too personal to resonate with the reader because it's too close to the truth. But yeah, there's a lot of my mum in my book. In this novel, there are kind of real moments with her. There are kind of specific things she said to me, which I've managed to put down and write about, and that's been really lovely, both for myself and kind of people that knew her and loved her, because through all the PR I've been talking about her, there's a huge picture of her in the Sunday Times, her name going out on kind of Women's Hour. All of that stuff is so special, to kind of feel like you are, and not just honouring your grief, but honouring the person you've lost, if that doesn't sound too cheesy.
No, I think it was very beautiful. I would love to hear an extract, please, Hattie, before we go on to talk more about the book.
Okay, I'm going to read the prologue. The prologue's quite important for me in this book, because I like the reader to know roughly what's going to happen at the end of the book without knowing how they're going to get there. Prologue. It took years for me to stop looking for Richard. With just a few clicks, if I wanted to, I could find some update on him. There'd be a new interview to read or an article that he had written himself, sometimes a television appearance to watch back. That kind of access to someone who is no longer a part of your life is just plain unhealthy. Well-meaning friends would message me when he won an award or had a big publication, saying things like, "I hope you're okay, I'm thinking of you." When they did, even years later, after I'd started to turn away rather than look into his light, it would prompt me to go online and search his name to see what they were referring to. There were times he would catch me off guard, a picture of his face in a newspaper I was reading, or worse, there looking back at me as I turned the page, his voice on the radio, suddenly like he was in the room with me again, his mouth next to my ear. He could not ever be contained because he was famous. He permeated the bounds of our own relationship and direct connections. It must be a small club to be a part of, to have loved and then lost someone whom the whole world has a piece of. Maybe that's why no one ever warns you.
Brilliant. It's such an intriguing opening to the book. So I'd like to talk a bit about Richard as a character. This is very timely. I'm not going to say anything that's going to get Radio Reverb in trouble, but very well-known writers are finally being exposed for inappropriate behavior in the publishing space. Did this kind of inspire and kind of the behavior of people with power in this industry inspire Richard as a character?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just publishing though, is it? It's everywhere. These men exist everywhere. It was, I mean, but there's also, obviously a lot of witnessed what I saw, what I'd known about going on in the publishing industry kind of went into this book. So that's kind of one part of it. But equally, I think Richard, there's a lot of Ted Hughes in Richard again, another very complicated, we'll say that. Yeah, allegedly complicated men. These kind of literary giants, a lot of these kind of male writers and the kind of the male writer ego and that kind of particular type of older male writer, the difficult people that you kind of come across all the time. But yeah, I mean, there are so many kind of open secrets in the publishing industry about a lot of these men, and then you get stories that you didn't expect about people, that you didn't think had a bad bone in their body. But yeah, it's just endless, isn't it? This kind of cycle of men and how they're treating young women. What's been quite complicated for me is when I wrote this book, I had to take out some of my judgment towards Richard because I had to write him as a layered character. Obviously, the whole book is from Charlie's perspective. It's written in first person, looking back as though she's writing a memoir. So I didn't have to kind of get deeply into his head, but I had to find something about him that I loved, that I felt sympathetic towards, and that was difficult. And it's also quite interesting, how I responded then to these kind of news stories about these, many, many men in the industry that have been kind of taken down for, the way they target women. It's odd. It's like, as a feminist, I find it very strange that I'm like, oh, this might have been going on with them. It's not that I'm ever excusing their behavior, but I'm always, it's just quite a dark place to be when you hear about these abusers and you're starting to think internally, like, oh, what makes them tick? But that's part of being a writer, isn't it? You have to go into the dark as well as the good. And if you want to write a genuine, interesting villain, baddie, antagonist, you have to have a bit of love and understanding and sympathy for them as well.
Absolutely. So I'm really interested, on a kind of side note, between the parallels between the music industry and the publishing industry, especially with how technology has changed things, how people doing it for themselves and finding success, has come about. And I'd just love to hear some of your observations, having worked in both of these industries.
Yeah, I mean, completely different. I don't have that much experience in the music industry, but the big difference is the publishing industry is predominantly women, and the music industry always is predominantly male. I mean, obviously, in publishing, then, the top dogs are always, not always, but often men. That's the kind of big one. The other kind of big difference between publishing and music is the class difference. Publishing is very elite. I think it's getting a bit better now. They've started to do things over the last kind of 5 or 6 years that have created more kind of entry points for people, which has been helpful. But I mean, they're both very messed up industries. I mean, I think a lot of these kind of creative arts industries are messed up. I actually just think kind of working for big companies and big corporations is, probably means you're going to work in a vaguely toxic workplace. The book is set in 2010, and things have been a lot more formalized. in publishing since then, but I think the book is a very kind of accurate depiction of an independent publishing house in kind of 2010 and the chaos that goes on there, the eccentric characters, the kind of behavior that you witness all the time that's kind of just excused as being, oh, it's just publishing, it's a bit quirky, you know. I think it's what's really interesting is that when you look at publishing portrayed in art and media, it's, you kind of think of it as being like a Bridget Jones movie, and it's nothing like that. It's ruthless, it's cutthroat. You know, as with music, they, you know, sign so many creatives and only a few of them really get the attention that they deserve. But yeah, both very cutthroat, difficult industries. But yeah, the main thing I would say would be the kind of the gender split.
So you were a publicist for years, and now you're on the other side of it. You are the author. You are the person. You know, I was looking at the endorsements for your books, you know, which are brilliant, and all these amazing authors. But you're now going to be on the other side of that, asking people that you've probably likely worked with over the years to read your book. And, you know, you're in these meetings on the other side of the table. What's that like?
Bizarre. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I worked in publishing for like 13 years. I started in publicity, moved into marketing, then moved into brand and editorial, and then literary festivals. So I've worked in quite a lot of different parts of publishing. And when I wrote this novel, I was so embarrassed. I didn't tell anyone I was writing it. It was only when it was finished, I told my best friend Chloe, who works in publishing, who'd worked with me in jobs for us. I was like, Chloe, I've written a novel. She was like, you just see her face. And I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to ask you to read it. She was actually, you know, as everyone has been, amazingly supportive and positive. But then when I got my agent and she was sending it out to all the... So once you get an agent, you work on your manuscript, it's in a good place, and then your agent will submit it to all the editors that they think will like it. And I was just like, oh my God, we'll have to change my name. I can't put my real name on it. And you'll have to send it out anonymously. And my agent was just like, yeah, I mean, you know, that'll quieten down interest, won't they, if I send an anonymous manuscript out? It's like, yeah, fair point. So I did end up using a slightly different name for publishing than when I worked in publishing. But yeah, it was really embarrassing. I think that's the main thing. And I don't find it embarrassing now, but when no one's read your book and you've written about sex and you've written about kind of mental health and all of these things, and, you know, especially written a publishing novel, you know that people are going to be looking at that character and thinking it is you. And as I said, you know, there's a lot of my experiences, but she is quite different. But, you know, I got over it quite quickly. It's a weird thing being a writer where you want to sell as many copies as possible. You want as many people to buy your book as possible, but you don't want anyone to actually read it, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. You do and you don't.
Yeah.
It's wonderful when people do. And now I'm kind of a bit further down the line. I love talking to people about my book. I love it when people read the book and ask me questions or tell me what they think about it. It feels amazing. But yeah, a lot of the process has been kind of eye-opening because, you know, I mostly speak to my agent. I do speak to my publicity and marketing and editorial teams at Orion. They're absolutely brilliant people. I love them. I'm so happy with the work they've done on the book. But yeah, a lot goes on between me and my agent. And, you know, a huge part of it is also kind of the other stuff that goes with it. So the international deals, the translation deals, the contractual stuff, all of that stuff I had no idea of from working in publishing, because that just goes on between the agent and the author. So yeah, I mean, every day has been a school day, certainly.
Friendship and its importance are really huge in the book. And I love the way that you depict friendship, especially the intensity of friendship in your early 20s and friendship between colleagues and friendship before things get kind of adult and people start having kids and, you know, doing grown up things. And there's such like a beauty and an innocence to it. Was this something that you consciously wrote, or did it come quite naturally?
Yeah, it came quite naturally. I think the one thing that I didn't have many intentions when I set out to write this book. It was very much following the story, following the character. I often don't really think about what I'm writing thematically until I've written the story, and then it becomes clear to me what I'm actually writing about. It's always just below the surface. What I wanted to do with this book is write really good, solid friendships. I feel like I was reading a lot of what we kind of call the millennial sad girl kind of fiction around this time, where friendships were used primarily to kind of drive conflict, and, you know, the friends were the antagonists, really. And actually, that isn't my experience of friendship at all. I've got wonderful friends, like, you know, the most incredible people, many of whom I met in publishing in my 20s, in the assistant trenches, you know, where you're working crazy hours, you're not really getting paid anything, you know, you're like always living on your last tenner, hungover, but still managed to get to work at 8:30 and everything's fine. And, you know, that was a really beautiful time in my life. I think also what the friendships in this book allowed me to do was to really be a mirror to Charlie, so that we can see how she feels about herself. Her two best friends in this book are from a completely different world to her. She's from, a tiny suburban town, and she's with, these two incredibly rich, wealthy people. And, it's really helpful for me to use those characters to write about, how Charlie sees herself, how she feels like an outsider. But then as we kind of go through the book, we realise that they feel like outsiders too, that everybody feels like an outsider. You're early to mid-20s when everyone starts treating you like a grown-up. You're like, I just moved out of halls, whatever. I didn't go to university. But if you've just come out of university, you're still very much a child in many ways. You are not, an adult. It's just how you're perceived and how you're talked to. And I loved writing about that. I also wanted this, this book goes to some quite dark places about kind of mental health and grief. And what I have found is it is the friendships that have sustained me through those kind of bad periods in my life. And I really, really hope that people take from this book that maybe they will speak to their friends if they're feeling sad, but also equivocally, that they might look out for their friends a little bit more if they're kind of in a bad place, and just see kind of, how helpful that kind of connection and friendship, especially when that's kind of in the workplace, can kind of be to people, especially when they're struggling.
Absolutely. So you are working on another book now. Congratulations. I know it's been announced. What has the process been of writing a second book? Because as you said earlier, we put so much of ourselves in our first book. Like, how did you, has the dreaded second novel thing happened?
I was so scared of the dreaded second novel thing that I wrote my second book immediately after I'd written my first book. So I kind of delivered like the final manuscript, like typeset manuscript, kind of in January 2024. And that's the same day that I started my second book. And I had the first draft done by the kind of beginning of March. So I essentially wrote two novels in a year, two first drafts in a year. The second book it's also really funny. So obviously, you spend so long thinking about your first book, and then when your agent goes out, they try and do a two book deal. So, the day before my agent's like, do you have any idea for the second book? Do you want to just send me a paragraph on it? It's just like, it took me 38 years to write that one, and I've got overnight. But I did kind of have something percolating. I went for a walk, do my best thinking when I'm walking or running. And just kind of wrote that. And I wrote it exactly in the same way that I wrote my first 7-week first draft. It's a more challenging novel. It covers a couple over 10 years. It's written from the third person, kind of alternating between a male and female perspective about this couple. So it was more challenging. The edit was a little bit more hardcore. It is typeset now, so it's really excited. So I'm kind of doing the proofing on the pages. It's always really special when your Word document comes back and you see it's, oh my God, this is an actual book. So that's quite special. The I think I'm having with my third book what most people have with their second book, because it was so long between my first book being written and coming out that I'm now trying to write my third, and it's been really hard to, I wrote, kind of 25,000 words earlier this year, and then I started the PR and kind of event touring, and then it's been quite hard to get my head back in. So that is my big job in January, is to try and get back in and find that headspace again that I had before I was published, to try and write the third book. So wish me luck.
You're going to nail it. If it's anything like this first one, you're absolutely fine, Hattie. So you're a writer based in Brighton. When did you move down here?
So I'm based in London now. I was based in Brighton for a really long time. So I kind of lived in London until I was 8, 9, then moved to Littlehampton, and then I moved to Brighton when I was 18. Mm-hmm. And lived there for about 8, 9 years. I have a lot of connections to Brighton. My family is still in Littlehampton. My family are either in Brighton and Littlehampton, essentially. So I spend a lot of time there. It was, a very formative time for me. It wasn't a lot of it wasn't the best time in my life. I moved there, just after my mum died when I was living there. It was quite a disruptive time. I was playing in bands, just kind of, making a bit of a mess of everything. But I love Brighton so much, and I was so glad that I got to put it in the book. So Charlie goes to Brighton University, so I get to write a bit about that kind of mid-2000s Brighton and the kind of the places that were so important to us, and that kind of life of kind of, walking through the North Lanes in like trousers where you cut the waistband off, and, strings of pearls, and I feel very, very affectionately towards Brighton because I spend so much time there, and I'm actually looking at setting the third novel there as well. So
brilliant. Well, you'll have to come back and tell us all about it. Hattie, thank you so much for joining us. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of the paperback of Bittersweet?
The paperback of Bittersweet is out in June, The paperback of Bittersweet is out in June 2026. The hardback is out now. You can find me on Instagram, Hattie Williams Writes. I have a website, hattiewilliams.com. And then I also write a weekly Substack. So that's all free. So if you want an essay on big feelings and emotions and life and grief and heartache, then you can find that through my Instagram as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A group of students jump off a train platform into the path of an arriving train. The lone survivor, Billy, cannot recall the incident, but is adamant that she and her friends weren't suicidal. Desperate for answers, Billy agrees to sign herself into the care of the Arbor Institute, a mysterious corporate-backed research body investigating a disturbing rise in similar incidents around the globe. At the Institute, Billy learns more about flock phenomena, where people band together to self-destruct. She is told that she is at risk of reflocking, and if she does, she will likely die. But not everything is as it seems. When Billy discovers that she and her fellow survivors have been completely cut off from the outside world, she realizes they may not be safe. And as she sets her sights on survival, the Institute may regret taking her under their wing, because this wounded fledgling might turn out to be a bird of prey. Catherine Bradley, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much, Hannah. It's really good to be here. Thanks. Great to chat again.
So The Institution is a terrifying, brilliant thriller. When did the idea come to you?
A while ago, and I was in a bar and I had read on Twitter, like the new concept of Twitter about how they knew it worked was that they were standing in a bar, which was why I was telling someone. And without a word, everybody that was sort of like new on Twitter got up and left at the same time. And it was this idea of like new types of communication. And I just thought it'd be really interesting that if you were watching that, and this is sort of going back way when, you know, social media was new, that would have been really interesting to watch that, like these people suddenly get up without a word and all move together. And I just thought that, you know, we're so immersed in that. And I just thought, take the idea of it being creepy and then make something really new about that would be pretty interesting, I think.
I really like how this is like slightly dystopian, but also feels very, very real. And, you know, the rise of big pharma and profit driven research and the kind of privatization of a lot of things is really scary. What was the research process like?
Yeah, really challenging, actually, I have to say. Definitely more challenging than I would like, because I think what's really important is when you're exploring new ideas that you keep one foot on the floor. Otherwise, I think that makes it too hard. So I wanted it to be really accessible, interesting in terms of an idea, maybe push the boundaries a little bit on what we know now, but totally set it in the present and the now. And I think, you know, I'm well in middle age now, and a lot of things that come through seem to be quite challenging to me, quite new. And I think a lot of when we turn on the news, we're perhaps worried about changes in society or not, or worried about other people's attitudes to that. I don't know. I think there's something new all the time that's challenging us as individuals or as society. And I think the new is where the possibilities are, but also where the fears are too.
Absolutely. So I know that you work with young people in Sussex as a teacher, and this book really follows a group of relatively young people. Billy, the protagonist, is only 24. Do you kind of pull on your experience of working with younger people to write in their voices?
Yes, definitely. I work in a building with 1,400 teenagers. I'm definitely around lots of young people. A lot of my colleagues are about that age as well. So I think what's good about that is it keeps it fresh for me. And I really enjoy their thinking, their ideas, their influences. I just think that younger people are a lot more adaptable to the new than maybe somebody in middle age like myself. So there we go. Yeah, I think they're more embracing and able to run with change in a way that maybe some of us are not.
And you must see how technology has had an impact on the young people's lives that you work with, and how that can cause a real groupthink mentality.
Yeah, absolutely. And mental health and impacts on young people is something that I, as a pastoral leader, so I teach, but I also lead a year group, is something that we talk about a lot. And I think it, when you're in it, I think that your viewpoint is different than when you're a little bit aside to it. So I think as, and I think, you know, I've referred to age twice, but I think how we experience the world is impacted by our age, our gender, you know, where we've grown up, etc. So I think for me, as an older person who didn't grow up with social media, then yeah, I'm definitely going to have a different perspective than somebody who has always had it in their life. And perhaps, I don't know, maybe, I don't know, maybe is a little bit more enmeshed in that world.
Can you read us a bit, please, Kate?
Yeah, certainly. Phase one, egg one. Will Becker scrutinized a group of 20-somethings through the stationary train's window. Six of them stood on the station platform waiting to board his carriage. Watching their unchecked energy, the last of his strength dimmed and his sigh steamed at the glass to fog, blurring them briefly. After leaving work early with a thumping headache, he'd been looking forward to beating the commuter rush home. The carriage was near empty, and after another row with sales that morning about next year's projections, he wanted, no, needed it to stay quiet. But as soon as the door slid open, the group's noise slammed into the silence, and the brief peace he'd salvaged was gone. He shifted in his seat, jaw tightened. He pretended to stare at the data charts open on his laptop, but instead checked the group's every move. Laughing at some continued joke, they filled the seats around him. The two men boys, one with frosted tips and another with overgrown mullet, dumped paper bags of takeout on his table and passed out chips and packages of burgers. A smell of cooked meat plunged Will's mood to pissy. The group were all dressed in baggy jeans or tracksuits. Some had piercings and tattoos. They were all just too cool, too loud, and too confident for Will's tastes. His irk continued as he watched the two men boys of about 20 throw their chips into their friend's mouth, yelping like sea lions, and he wondered if he shouldn't just get up and move. The train lurched out of East Croydon station. They reached past him with a bag of chips. "Don't even see me," he thought. Was he old enough to be invisible? He looked at two young women. They both wore short-cut tops, and but before they sat down, he noticed slim waists above low-slung tracksuit bottoms. He might be 49, but it wasn't so long ago that he knew how it felt to rest his hands on waists like theirs. Feeling sick, not just at the burger smell and the lurchy carriage as the train picked up pace, but because he knew he'd never hold a waist like that again. Chips were now on the floor. One of the three girls, the cure t-shirt, was now jumping up and shrieking, making the boys laugh. Another, with long wavy red hair, sat diagonally across from him. Cream skin, freckles, just a little too thin. But even so, she was beautiful. He tried not to watch as she plaited her hair. She listened to her friends and obediently opened her mouth so her friend could post a chip in. He didn't want to stare. Goodness, he wasn't that sort of man. But it was interesting to see how she sectioned her hair, then flicked it with a quick weave with expert, fast fingers. Her control was mesmerizing. The train accelerated, then juddered as it almost immediately cut to half speed. An announcement over the system informed them, "Dear passengers, we regret that due to a technical fault, customers will be asked to disembark at the next station. This will be Gatwick Station. Customers will be able to take the next train to continue their journey. We apologise for the inconvenience." He liked the group a little better when Frosted Tips complained of expletives, expressing what Will was thinking inside. Did nothing work properly these days? That's it, he decided. I am getting old. The door opened, and this time he followed the group onto Gatwick Station platform. Though it was May, storm clouds threatened rain, and the wind felt bitingly brutish. Today was supposed to be hot, he thought, angry he'd left his jacket at home. Everything seemed to be going wrong. Fiddling with his phone to open the travel app, He moved only when an announcement told him the platform crowds the next train would not be stopping at the station, warning fast train approaching. He shuffled obediently back from the platform's edge along with the other passengers. And then it happened. Afterwards, with weak police-issue sweet tea gripped in his cold, shaking hands, he recalled what happened. Distracted by his travel app and watching the platform attendant struggle with a barrage of people, he only half noticed the group. "But I did notice it, notice them, and how strange they were," he said, describing their sudden, sharp switch from exuberance to silence. "They just stopped moving. Stop speaking. They all started acting the same, not there, as if they'd had a crucial circuit severed." He cried, hunched over the interview room table, the machine recording his distress. The police were kind. But what then could be done? They were already dead. He wept as he described what the police already knew, how the train had raced towards the platform, how a lady had spilled the contents of her bag everywhere, just as one of the group, Frosted Tips, broke away from the crowd. How Frosted Tips walked firmly towards the edge of the platform. How the girl with the Cure t-shirt was already following him. How she didn't react as he stepped, without pause, off the platform edge and onto the track. How she continued to follow him and also dropped out of sight. How she had made a noise. She hit the rails below, how the rest of the group had followed in the same focused way. "Like dead-eyed lemmings," he'd said later in his statement. "One jumped and they all did. All jumped in less than 5 seconds. Bam, 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 bam. They just kept jumping." He remembered the shove of people around him as they realised what was happening, how the not-stopping train continued to approach with alarming speed, how the train driver had sounded the horn. Hearing the screeching of brakes, seeing the driver, eyes and mouths echoing Munch's the scream, which seemed apt because there was nothing natural now about the group or what was happening. How Will's status finally broken. There was one still teenager left on the platform. One. He ran for the girl with the long wavy red hair, reaching her just centimetres from the platform edge. The plaited scene, her twist together, hung behind her like a rope. He grabbed it and held on. Her neck snapped back. He held on. She tugged against it and he grabbed her shoulder as she pulled her hair free. She pulled again against his grip. "Strong," he told the police. She was so strong and he knew in that moment he couldn't hold her. The idea of her slipping from him was so clear it was as if he could see it happen. But then he had help. Another man came and held her too. Still, she fought them. Not in a violent way, he told the police, more like a train that keeps moving with a steady tenacity. Then he had understood the ridiculousness of the comparison and had been sick in the police station loo. After the other man had joined them, the train guard had arrived and the three of them had held the girl as the train ploughed through the station in a squeal of brakes, the sound of metal on metal, and then another noise that he didn't want to think about. No one had cried out. No hand reached for help. The police asked if he knew who the other man who had helped save the girl's life. They wanted to contact him for their inquiries. "No," Will confirmed. "He was right there moving to save her at the same time as me, but he was slowed down by the woman who'd spilled her bag, so I reached her first." "He didn't give you his name?" Will had shaken his head. "And by the time you guys arrived, he'd gone, but I'd know him anywhere. He had the bluest eyes I'd ever seen. He deserves a medal. Without him, I wouldn't have been able to save the girl with the red hair."
Thank you so much, Catherine. It's such a gripping opening to a book. When you were drafting it, did it always start with this really dramatic, inciting incident from a point of view that we actually don't see again in the book?
Yes, and it felt risky, actually, because normally you want to bed in, don't you, immediately with your character, and you want to spend that time. But of course, this is the story of the girl with the red hair. And I think to see what happened to her from not her perspective felt really important, because she fights against that because she doesn't have a memory of it. that's something that I think we need to have the surety that it did happen, that what she experienced was so unusual, and so unknown. And it's not until she later speaks with a journalist who suggests that this is a global phenomena that we start to get this idea that actually it's so much bigger than her, and what happened to her friends.
Absolutely. So you obviously write thrillers in a really, really brilliant way. Was this always a story that was going to translate to being a thriller for you? Or were there other ways that you could have written it, more like a police procedural or a kind of different sort of crime novel?
Yes, I mean, I do sort of think about these things, but I think ultimately you come back to what you like reading yourself. And actually, I've got sort of broad church of taste, but I do love a page turner. I think with today's distractions, that's even more important. Everybody complains about suffering from, not being able to focus, perhaps, or attention. Lives are busy. There's a lot going on. There's a lot competing for our time. So I really rely on something that feels compulsive.
So, Billy, our redheaded protagonist, gets taken to a psychiatric ward and then moved to the Arbour Institute. The Arbour Institute is in Scotland. It's very remote. It's on an island, which is very difficult to reach. Are there places that exist like this? And did you do some travelling so you could get into that setting?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the first thing I'd say is I have worked on a locked psychiatric ward for a year, so that really felt really easy for me to sort of bring alive that as a location. And I really wanted this sort of sharp juxtaposition between, well, when I described the Institute, it was my dream place to go to. I mean, I love a spa, who doesn't? And I have been to Scotland and up onto the West Coast and spent time around that part of the area to really sort of immerse myself in the beauty there, and wanted to sort of try and capture that. And for me, a spa, Scotland, I adore, felt like the very most the place I would like to be, I think. So I thought, well, where better place to sort of like hit somewhere that is full of well, what would frighten me anyway.
There's something really appealing to me about a novel that explores something really dark somewhere very beautiful.
Yeah, me too, me too.
What
Me
writers
too.
influence you? So I was definitely getting a bit of Leanne Moriarty when I was reading this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, gosh, there's so many writers I adore. I've just read the Jack Jordan's latest. I love that for sort of like that page turning. I love, gosh, I so many different writers, probably too many to sort of pick on, really. I'm just looking at my bookshelf rather. Yeah, I still like a Grisham for that sort of page turner. In terms of beauty, though, I think the place, the location itself, has to be the sort of the inspiration, really. So I took loads of photos when I was there, did a lot of walking, a lot of being in nature, because that was what I really wanted to shine on the page.
Another thing that happens a lot in the books is Billy has visions of birds, and birds play quite a big part in it, in her memories of her late father and also in the kind of flocking mentality. Did you have to do quite a lot of research on birds and their behaviours?
Yes, definitely. But I quite like that anyway. I like, but I mean, I'm a real animal lover. I haven't eaten meat since I was five. I love animals. I've got, three tortoises, gerbils, cat. I love my animals. And I don't know, in another life, I would probably quite like to sort of keep a falcon myself. I looked into it and watched some documentaries on it and did give it some thought. But they take over a large part of your life, and I'm too busy for that. But I was really happy to spend that time. And I really like the motif of freedom, which, of course, Billy doesn't have, or if she's got the keys to it, she doesn't know how to or where to use those yet. So that idea of sort of being trapped and yet free, I love birds. I spend a lot of time looking at birds actually when I write, because I overlook my garden and I've got a bird table set up there, and we've got a sparrow hawk that comes visiting that makes my cat very nervous. So I love birds.
So, Catherine, you are a writer in Brighton. How or does the city influence you, and what's it like to be a writer here?
Well, I love Brighton and I love the freedom to be that Brighton offers. I used to work for years with the homeless, so I'm very aware of the different sort of levels of Brighton that there are out there, you know, the different subcultures. But I think that's what gives it its identity, really, is that it is a place for everybody. And then, of course, we're right by the sea. So you've got that real natural contrast between some beautiful architecture, modern and obviously, you know, Edwardian and Victorian. And we've got the Downs as well. And my favourite, and I've lived in several places in Brighton, my favourite place was Ovingdean, actually, which is part of Brighton. But you've got you know, I think I like contrasts with the countryside, and then you've got sort of city life as well, with some of the, I think, some of the greatest pubs in the country, actually.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So what's next for you, Kate? What are you working on?
Well, I'm working on another Catherine Brett Bradley novel, big questions again. So I do like ideas about control and breaking free of control, whether it's government or pharma or, you know, world events, is probably what I would hint at for that one. Big world events and about how that impacts on the individual. But also really interested in just sort of writing another sort of straightforward domestic thriller as well. So I'm working on that as well. So lots to keep me busy.
Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine. How can people find and follow you and pre-order their copy of The Institution?
Yeah, so I think it's on all the major sites, obviously Amazon, but all the bookshops there are, Waterstones, etc. And I'm on Twitter at Kate underscore Bradley. So yeah, that'd be great if people did. That'd be fantastic.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I am joined by my friend and fellow facilitator, the wonderful Kate Beals, to talk about a writing retreat which we are teaming together to run again in March from the 23rd to the 28th, 2026. Welcome, Kate.
Hello, Anna. Good morning.
Can you introduce yourself to us, please?
Well, I am a theatre maker by background, and I'm also a writer. And I live partly in London and also partly in the beautiful Italian village of Calamandrana, which is where we host retreats.
Absolutely. So we had the pleasure of running a retreat together in November. It was the first one of this kind that you had run there. How was it for you?
Oh, Anna, it was so lovely. I think apart from the absolute delight of working with you, and you're such a pro and you know what you're doing brilliantly, the moment when all the writers arrived and as I watched them settle in, as and I watched them figure out where they wanted to be, and every morning I'd wake up and see writers sitting in different places, working, getting on with it, walking, talking, thinking. And I watched everybody kind of visibly relax and make themselves at home and find their individual space. And that was just the most beautiful feeling.
It really is a magic, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, it's very, very special. I thought it
If
was.
we say so ourselves, of course. So,
Okay.
what do you think coming to the retreat could benefit a writer who is just starting and also one who's really deep into their work as well?
Yeah, and we had both, didn't we? So I think for somebody who's just starting out, there's enormous value in being on the journey, even the tiniest bit, with some other people and seeing that other people have the same challenges or they have solutions to your challenges, you know, alternatives, ideas, things you hadn't thought of before. And to kind of feel that collective momentum of writing with other people, of being in a few classes and sessions where people are working out stuff together, not being so alone. I think that is brilliant. And the other side of the coin is that there's space at Casa Luna to be completely alone if you just want to get on with it in a space that feels very far away from everything else in the world. It feels very creative. There's something in the energy, something in the water in that place. It's full of creativity. And people feel very able to just settle and find their space and get on with their writing.
So, what transformations did you see over the week? Were there any that really stood out for you?
There were a couple, I think, that were to do with confidence. So maybe early writers who, or writers who wanted to step to the next level, who really did grow massively in confidence through the week. There were also a couple who solved a problem, who went, oh, I've been wrestling with this for ages and I've finally sat down, or I've had some chats with another writer and now I've just worked through that tangle and I've managed to unknot that mess that I was in. And then there were a couple of others who were in the category of just saying, I've just had hours and hours of quiet focus time and I have done the 3,000 words or the 30,000 words or the 50,000 words that I needed to get done in order to progress.
So let's talk about the place. Casaluna is a very, very special, special place. What is it about this setting that you think is so inspirational for writers?
What is it? Well, it's so many things. For a start, it feels very isolated, but it's actually not. So it's quite convenient to get to. But it's at the top of a hill. Nobody goes past. The house is surrounded by woods and vineyards. So you get to the top of a little tiny road and there's nothing else there. You're never going to be in any way disturbed by, you know, lorries going past or the postman or anybody else really who's not part of the group coming by. Everything is green. It's surrounded by green. The woods and the trees hang over. You hear the birds, you hear the creatures of the forest. You wake up with the sunlight and that's kind of all there is. And there's something about that that feels very precious. And at the same time, we're actually not that far from the village and we're surrounded by people who love us and who know us. We've lived there for 20 years now. And the people in the surrounding village want to help. They want to see writers working. They want to bring us homemade food. They want to do anything they can to support us on this journey. And that's a lovely feeling too. So we're isolated, but we're in a community.
Yeah, that's one thing I particularly loved about the retreat, how we kind of made this team around us and everything was locally sourced. Can you talk a little bit about this and the food in particular?
Yeah. Okay. So in our village is a wonderful chef called Nadia. She runs the local shop, the delicatessen, I guess you'd call it, in a city. It's a little local food shop and she provides local supplies and she cooks. She cooks every day. She cooks beautiful traditional Italian food and she provided meals for us every day. And it was all traditional Piemontese cooking and that's everything from a really good lasagna to something very traditional of the region, for example, a bagna cauda. So a bagna cauda is how to describe it. It's like a sort of really warm fondue style dish, not with cheese, but where you have a kind of heated bubbling sauce in front of you and dip local vegetables into the sauce. And that's super delicious. We also have a wonderful local bakery. And the local bakery provided us with beautiful homemade bread and pastries and anything else we needed. And down the road at the garage, we have Giovanna. And Giovanna runs the garage, and that is her day job. But she has an amazing side job cooking desserts. And she provided the tiramisu.
She did, which was probably one of the best I've ever had. So shortly, I'm going to quickly talk about what the retreat includes and how people can come along if they'd like to. But I'd really like to talk a little bit about you as a writer, Kate. So your debut novel, Broken Horses, came out in 2025. It's available via Amazon and directly from the publisher, Linen Press, if you'd like to support independence, which you should. Can you tell us a bit about this book and maybe read us a short extract?
Okay, thank you. Yes, Broken Horses, I'm so delighted that it was published this year. I'd spent many years writing Broken Horses. It's a story that emerged out of my own curiosity, of my own family history. My father was born in southern Patagonia in Chile, and my grandmother had travelled there alone on a boat at the turn of the century, last century. And I was really curious about that and how anybody would go there and why and what it would be like to go to such an inhospitable, faraway place. And of course, when I got there, it was a pretty brutal and tough world. And there was a lot of research to be done about the colonial history of that region of the world. And the more I did, the more I dug in, the more fascinated I became, the more excited I became. And the result of that is Broken Horses, which is fiction. It's a novel. I'll just read you a very short excerpt. This is from very early in the story, where the main character, whose name is Georgie, has just stepped off the boat in Punta Arenas, which is a pretty grey, grim place. I actually travelled there by boat myself, did the same journey because I wanted to just see how that would feel. And it's, you know, it's, what can I say? It's not an easy place to stop and walk off. It's not particularly welcoming, but extraordinary in its own way. And this is the first thing that happens to Georgie. Three women walk arm in arm across the broad street that runs beyond the quay. From the ease and freedom of their gait, they seem about my own age, and with a burst of optimism, I run after them. Perhaps they'll speak English. But when I draw closer, something in the bold sachet of their hips, the current of attention rippling through the crowd around them, gives me pause. A man calls out, and they spin round, coloured ribbons fluttering against bony angles of rouged and cavernous cheeks. Before I can look away, the nearest, a girl of about 16, catches my eye. She stops, narrowing her eyes in concentration, tilting her head as if trying to place me. Her thin face is ravaged with scars. "What do you want, English lady?" The hostility in her tone skewers me. My feeble Spanish withers on my lips. The girl leers at my discomfort and hitches up her skirt, thrusting her hips in an obscene dance. Her companions laugh as they take her by the arms and pull her away. One of them looks back over her shoulder with a wink, rolling her eyes, tapping a finger against the side of her head as they disappear into the crowd. The girl is mad. It shouldn't matter. I've seen worse at the hospital, far worse. Yet there was an expression on her face, not just of hatred, but of recognition, as if she knew me and I had done her harm.
Thank you so much, Kate. That is beautifully read. So you can talk more to Kate about her brilliant book if you come along to the retreat. I'm going to quickly run through what is included, because I'm really proud to be able to offer something which feels genuinely affordable and like really brilliant value for writers. So for £920, which might sound like a lot, however, if you are looking at comparable retreats in the market, this is about half what a week-long retreat would be, especially abroad. So we will have a pre-retreat Zoom call with the group. We will have 2 hours of workshops a day with either myself or with Kate. We will have 3 evening feedback sessions. You get all your accommodation for 5 nights in a comfortable private room with a lovely, comfortable double bed. There are no ensuite bathrooms, but the maximum people you'll be sharing with is one other person. There are plenty of beautiful spaces to write inside and outside. Every room has a writing desk in it. Every day there is yoga or movement or breath work in the afternoon. You have access to an unheated pool. You have 3 nutritious, delicious meals a day. Soft drinks, tea and coffee available. Local wine available to purchase. A special final evening pizza party. Airport transfers are all included to the specified flights from and to Gatwick. And you have the chance to walk or cycle around the beautiful Italian countryside for inspiration. We even have wellies that you can use. We also have yoga mats that you can use. And you can travel really light because we have laundry facilities as well. So as I said, I've worked in the writing and retreat space for a while now, and this really is the best value that I have come across and feel really glad to be able to offer it. There are only 3 places left on the retreat. It's a small group. There won't be more than 13 people there. So if you are interested, don't hesitate to get in touch. You can book now also and pay in February. We have a free bursary place available, and the deadline to apply for that is the 30th of January. And we also have 1 half price place for a very comfortable side room. All the details, including testimonials, are at the website, which is casalunagetaways.com, and also linked at our bio on Instagram at BTN Book Club. Kate, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I'm personally so looking forward to working with you again. And do you have any last smidges of wisdom that you want to impart on anyone who might be on the fence about investing in this time for themselves?
For me, it's a combination of working with others, making friends who support you on your writing journey. And also for me, I know I can write more when I'm away at Casa Luna in 5 days than I can at home in 5 weeks. And I'm just going to throw that out there too.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you so much for listening to the Brighton Book Club. You can follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club, and you can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. We will be back with a lovely new show for you soon. Take care and a very happy new year.